From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Seeking Savior. Must be charismatic, media savvy, and fun at parties. Nope, this isn't a copy for a personal ad. In recent years, it's become the want ad for the American CEO. Many of the country's top companies have gone looking for an outsider with a messianic vision to save their futures. Our guest tonight, Harvard Business School professor Rakesh Khurana, has studied the hiring and firings of CEOs at over 850 American companies. And he doesn't like what he sees. Too much charisma, too little competence. Selecting a corporate chief executive, he says, is often like crowning Napoleon. In his new book, Searching for a Corporate Savior, The Irrational Quest for Charismatic CEOs, Khurana says charisma does not deliver, and mechanisms that we use for choosing our corporate leaders are selecting the wrong top guns. Do you buy the thesis that charisma is a losing quality in the corner office? Has charisma worked for you and your company? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Rakesh Khurana, professor at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Searching for a Corporate Savior, The Irrational Quest for Charismatic CEOs. Good evening and welcome, Rakesh Khurana.
Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hi.
Rakesh Khurana, we've all kind of been half facetiously and half very seriously in the past several months been taught to think that greed was the problem with corporate America today. But you say it's something else, that it may in fact be charisma that's somewhere around the heart of the problem. Why? How?
Well, I think part of the issue is that in recent years, the CEOs that we were hiring and that boards were choosing in corporations were often being chosen not necessarily because they had the strategic skills or an understanding of the industry or an understanding of their culture of their organization, but increasingly chosen because of their appeal to analysts on Wall Street, to the reaction of the business media. Consequently, they were being chosen more for their press release value and the confidence they would inspire in these external constituents, and a lot less with respect to what they could do for the organization in terms of solving its problems.
When you say that they were chosen because of their charisma, what exactly do you mean? What is this thing, charisma, and why would it come to be the arbiter of who's chosen to head up enormous and small and mid-sized American companies?
Well, I think to understand this, we actually have to go back to the roots of who's sort of running and controlling our large corporations. Over the last 30 years, with the rise of the institutional investors and the greater participation of the American public in the stock market, our notions and conceptions of what our CEOs and executives should be like has changed dramatically. It used to be thought that what you wanted in an executive was a competent administrator, somebody who understood the organization, grew up in the ranks of the organization. But with the sort of cultural marker of Lee Iacocca in the late 1970s, early 1980s, our conceptions of what CEO should be like shifted from this sort of notion of a capable administrator to the idea of a leader. And by that, I mean a leader with a capital L. CEOs were now supposed to provide a vision for the organization. They were supposed to put together a mission statement. There was a focus and emphasis on values. So the notions of sort of religious terms, you know, coming in from the areas of the sacred started coming into the areas of the profane in terms of what organizations were supposed to be like. Organizations were not about making money anymore, but fulfilling sort of a vision.
I'm getting whiplash here because we all spent so many years going so far down that road. The number of business books about leadership and mission statements and vision, I mean, these were the be-all and end-all. These are what you had to have if you wanted to succeed in the new economy, in any economy. You're telling us that that was bunk and that guys who came forward were just blowing smoke?
I think what we saw there was the sort of rise of what I call the leadership consulting industrial complex. This focus on CEOs really sort of takes our focus away from what are the main drivers of organizational performance. In the vast amount of academic research that's been done on this subject with respect to understanding what leads to organizational performance and what leads to organizational survival, it's not clear that CEOs exert a huge effect. In fact, the first effect that we know is simply what industry are you in? So you could take the best performing mining company, and over a five-year period, it will do less well than the worst performing pharmaceutical company for basic reasons such as intellectual property, patents, research and development. It's very consistent with Warren Buffett's adage, which is that you take a good manager and you put him in a bad business, it's usually the reputation of the business that stays intact.
If that's the case, if CEOs at the end of the day have no great effect,
then why not have a charismatic CEO? May attract better people, may attract more attention, may attract better analyst coverage, as you say, may pump your stock price up. If they don't have much effect, why not have a jazzy one?
Because the problem is that charisma has always been antithetical to critical reasoning. It's always been antithetical to rationality. What happens when you have charismatic leadership is that it tends towards centralization. And one of the consequences you see, for example, is the combination of the chairman and CEO position, where there's sort of an imperial CEO who rules, and no one can really question that individual. The second thing is that it leads to a concentration of information and decision-making, which is the last thing that you really need in our information, knowledge-intensive organizations. So it has a lot of second-order consequences, which are quite negative for companies in terms of building long-lasting capabilities.
Americans, I think, though, think in terms of organizations doing well with charismatic leaders. We think of General Patton in Europe. We think of General MacArthur in Asia in World War II. Very charismatic generals who, you know, got the job done and inspired a lot of people along the way. Is business different somehow?
I think business is different, and I think there's even an overemphasis in our political environments on those same kind of attributions. People tend to discount the role of situations in terms of what accounts for organizational performance. When we deal with complex events, one of the sort of errors that human beings make in terms of trying to understand complex events is what's called the fundamental attribution error. We tend to see things in terms of the person who's in the middle of the situation rather than the contextual factors. For example, in the 1990s, it was often believed that Alan Greenspan controlled the economy or that the economy depends on the president of the United States. Thinking like this really borders on irrationality because it doesn't take into account the complex set of factors that go into this account. And as our society in particular loves the notion of individualistic accountability, the sort of imagery of the cowboy, the imagery of the sheriff coming into clean town has always been very appealing to sort of the American persona and the American ideal.
Jack Beatty, my head is spinning here nevertheless. The 80s, the 90s, especially the 90s, were in violent opposition to the man in the gray flannel suit. I hear in Rakesh Khurana's thesis a kind of unstated notion that it's the somber, good corporate cog in the wheel who gets the job done. We were supposed to have charismatic leaders who took us into a new economy. How does the gray flannel suit fit in that picture?
I don't know, but it's always agreeable to have one's intuition supported by scholarship, and that was the case in reading this book, for me at least. What strikes me, Professor Karami, is that that in your book, charisma is kind of a proxy for hiring an outsider who'll fire. I mean, that a lot of these, it just seems to me that a lot of these charismatic leaders, I mean, Al Dunlap is the Chainsaw Al, is the classic case, are hired by boards from the outside to do the dirty work, to get rid of the people inside that an inside man just wouldn't have the stomach for. And as you say, in our current investor capitalism, and I think that concept is very important, layoffs are one of the ways to generate higher stock price. And this sort of perverse prosperity of herding workers to generate higher stock prices for their pensions is seems to be the preferred route rather than making a better product. What about that? The hiring to fire character of the charismatic leader.
I think your point is dead on, because what happened in the 1990s was that sort of insiders were seen as weak, that what you really wanted was an outsider CEO, and an outsider who was willing to sort of make decisions such as downsizing, such as cutting R&D, such as taking on more debt and more leverage in the company, which insiders were unwilling to take. I think you're making a great point, Jack, because one of the things that's really interesting is that if you take the one CEO who's sort of held up as the example as sort of one of the great CEOs over the last two decades, Jack Welch, even he got painted as an outsider, even though the reality, the facts were that he was a 30-year career person at General Electric. But rather than change the theory to fit our facts, we changed our facts to fit our theory, because he was coming from plastics, as if plastics was some obscure division. If you remember the movie The Graduate, plastics was like the internet of the 1960s.
But he acted like the outsider coming in. He was willing to swing the axe and lay off lots of people and to reshape General Electric in many dimensions. But does that mean that an insider would necessarily be better? Somebody who had a vested interest, perhaps, in the people, in the plants, and perhaps in yesterday's operations, yesterday's industry?
Well, I think you're making an interesting point, which is that, you know, we want people to make decisions that are in the best interest of the organization. And if that involves having to reshape the company or downsize the company or shift the strategy, we want to do that. The question is, what is the best way to get people to do that? What's the best way to take people's organizational interests into heart? So if we want to stick with the GE example, I mean, Jack Welch, I respect very much as a manager. I think he did a great job. But we have to remember that Jack Welch was a product of a system. Mm-hmm. A system that over a century produced a string of great CEOs.
An internal General Electric system.
And Reginald Jones, who was his predecessor, was as highly regarded, if not more regarded, as an executive. Let me just give an example. When I was doing my research, one of the things that board members would say to me, Rakesh, where is our Jack Welch? As if some curse had befallen their company that they couldn't find the right kind of individual to run their company. And my response to them was, what have you done to develop your Jack Welch? We actually know things that companies like General Electric and Procter & Gamble and Johnson do. They invest very heavily in recruiting individuals. They invest very heavily in terms of management development and executive development. They carefully match people to positions. It often takes several years before they make the decision. In fact, in the most recent succession at General Electric, we know there was a 3 or 4 year mm-hmm. horse race. Mm-hmm. Those things are actionable. What many boards did in recent years, though, was sort of avoid making those kinds of decisions of investing and developing people, and instead outsourced it to sort of a dubious industry of the executive search industry. And when they sort of promised the world to them, they would hire these individuals, pay them whatever they had the chutzpah to demand, and when they didn't work out, they would walk away with lots of severance. And I think that's put us into a very bad situation, into a situation that we're now sort of suffering in terms of both our stock price and the stock market, and also the lack of development in people in our corporations.
When boards turned to executive recruiters to bring in these CEOs, what was the kind of talent pool or the profile of the person they were likely to bring in?
Well, if you look at what they would look at, they would list a string of personal characteristics. This person should be a visionary. They should sort of have high integrity. They should be missionary-oriented. There would sort of be a string of long personal characteristics. What's interesting, though, is who did they end up bringing in? What you get this illusion that there's some sort of market and the executive search firm is searching high and wide in this market. But the reality is that boards were not choosing from a wide market. In fact, what they were often choosing were people who were already known to them. The main criteria that determined whether you were in the consideration set for being a CEO for a company to be considered for that position was, are you already a president or CEO at another company? Hmm. Are you coming from a high-performing company? So they're making the attribution that CEO quality and firm performance are highly correlated, something we just talked about, mm-hmm. in fact, is much more weakly
correlated.
Ain't
necessarily so.
Exactly. And are you coming from a highly regarded company? You know, Harvard didn't look in the community college market for its last president. So by the time they use these criteria, they end up focusing on a narrow group of people chosen more because of their defensibility and the sort of cover your posterior decision making than anything having to do with what the problem that company was facing.
Jack Beattie, it sounds as though we're being told that America spent 10 or 20 years recruiting the wrong people to lead its companies.
and certainly recruiting people who did not lead by integrity, which isn't to say that this was true of all of these people. But they were hired sort of for their flash and for their willingness to fire and not necessarily for their knowledge inside the business. To me, the best story of leadership I know from my industry, the magazine industry, is of William Shawn at The New Yorker. In the 1970s, they published the first of a three-part article that by a very prominent author. They advertised it full-page ad in the New York Times. They ran the first version. The second version, the author balked at cutting out a few adjectives. And a friend of mine, who was the sub-editor, went into Mr. Shawn and said, he won't cut these. And Shawn said, well, there's nothing for it. We'll just have to tell him that we can't go ahead with it. You might say the New Yorker exists not to publish prose of that character. You have to tell the business office, can't do it. He was ready to cancel the whole thing over an aesthetic issue. That is leadership.
Gosh, it's kind of inspiring, Jack. It might even be a kind of charisma. What could be going on here? We're talking tonight about the charismatic CEO. What works best in a CEO, competence or charisma? A red tie or a gray flannel suit? And have charismatic CEOs made American business great or driven it into a ditch? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the charismatic CEOs and the CEO and the pitfalls of relying too much on charisma to pull the corporate engine. Our guest is Rakesh Khurana. He's professor at Harvard Business School and author of the new book, Searching for a Corporate Savior, The Irrational Quest for Charismatic CEOs. You can join us as well. Do you buy the thesis that charisma is a losing quality in the corner office, in the CEO? Has charisma worked for you and your company? And if not charisma, then what is great leadership in business? What makes it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rakesh Khurana, we were being playful before the break, but I wonder, are you suggesting that after 10 or 20 years of charisma being a highly sought-after characteristic in CEOs, that the top ranks of American business are loaded with the wrong people?
I think what I am suggesting is that the processes that are currently being used for selecting our executives, the processes that most boards use and the process which guides their decision-making tends to lead them toward focusing on marquee names at the expense of focusing on the strategy of the company and the problems facing the company.
But that dodges the question. After 10 or 20 years of that, do we have a national problem in that we've recruited the wrong leadership?
I think in some companies, again, not all companies went to this, we did have this problem. And the companies are some of the most obvious ones include Tyco, WorldCom, Enron. All of these companies were headed by individuals who were celebrated by the business media, often known for their charismatic qualities. Jeff Skilling's analyst meetings, for example, were described as revival meetings. And one has to ask the question, why do people like Scott Sullivan, the CFO at WorldCom, or Andy Fasto, the CFO at Enron, just go along with an individual without criticizing anything they have to do and actually undertake activities that have put their organizations, if not in danger, are clearly illegal activities. The only authority that we know of, in terms of if you think about why people pay attention to someone, where does someone's legitimacy of their authority comes from? It comes from either one of three sources. One is that you have personal allegiance to that individual, and this is what charismatic authority is. It's about personal allegiance, personal vision, a personal loyalty. The other one is rational authority, which is about questioning. It's about competence. It's about being able to say no because the demands of the office versus the loyalty to the individual are quite different. And we had a very, very clear shift toward the charismatic leader. Our leaders were thought to have a vision. They were thought to be able to motivate, sort of express this idea that, company was about more than simply making money. It was about fulfilling a mission. And while that's motivating at one point, it also creates a situation where you have very unstable organizations.
Why?
Well, charisma has always stood on the idea that it's not simply about reproducing the status quo. It's not simply about predictability. It's all about change. It's all about sort of doing something different. It's all about fulfilling the vision of a single individual.
But mission statements were supposed to provide a rudder underneath a company that kept it headed toward a great destiny.
Well, I think, again, mission statements can be useful in that sense. But what happens is if the mission statement turns out to be a hallucination, when you can't question or ask what is the purpose of this mission statement, and the individual sort of – you're either categorized as someone who either gets it or doesn't get it, that creates conditions where nobody wants to be seen as not getting it. And this is apparently what happened in the board of Enron, where nobody wanted to question. They didn't understand how the company was making money, but it was very clear that under this messianic individual, Jeff Skilling, that they were making money and things were going great. And even if you're the sort of, an accounting professor from Stanford, you didn't want to be seen as not getting it. So charisma has always been able to crowd out rational skepticism.
Tom, can I put
yes,
in here
please,
for a second?
Yes, please, Jeff.
A good contrast to this talk about the charismatic leader who sort of has gifts of grace and who divines things in the market and so on is what really makes for great business, and that is strategic judgment. And perhaps the greatest example in modern times is with IBM, which we think of as gray personified. But in the 1960s, in 1961, they concluded that their products were aging, that the computer they had was not going to be the new generation. And they decided to develop a new product, System 360. They invested $5 billion in it, which was three times their revenue at the time. Mm-hmm. They hired 60,000 new workers, and they redid the entire company knowing that their extant computer, I forget the name of it, would be undone by this new one, betting the whole farm on it. Mm-hmm. And it worked. And it became perhaps the most successful big-ticket product innovation since the Model T. That was a strategic judgment. You can only make that kind of judgment. It was made by Thomas Watson Jr. and others by really knowing the business inside.
Mm. But I wonder if charisma precludes really knowing the business. Hold that thought. We have callers who want to join us. We want to invite them in. Max is on the line. Welcome, Max. You're on the air.
Thanks for putting me on. Rakesh, I have a question. I went on the Harvard Business School website, mm-hmm. and I saw that the MBA applications heavily emphasize the leadership qualities. And so to say that applicants need to show that they're future leaders. Mm. Yet in your book, you emphasize quite the opposite point of view. So can you reconcile of the official school position and what you suggest in your book?
Ooh, Max, you're tough. How about it, Rakesh Khurana? Is Harvard Business School itself and many other business schools around the country, no doubt, recruiting for charisma?
I don't think Harvard Business School recruits for charisma. The kind of leadership that we recruit for and hopefully we're developing in our students is a leadership that's oriented toward our society, a leadership that recognizes that the shareholder is not the only constituent that a manager or a leader is responsible for. Moreover, I don't think we're a school in many ways which sort of says, once you graduate here, you're a leader. But rather, we're a school that prepares people to learn to lead in the future and gives them the right mindset and the right tools to prepare for doing that. I'm not against leadership per se. I think leadership is an important quality. I'm against when we sort of think that leaders have to possess a particular type of quality and that they're actually different from the rest of us. When we create a different set of rules for leaders and then the rest of us. When we believe that not everyone is capable of being a leader. Those are the kind of things that I think the leadership consulting complex grew. And that's how we got to the situation we're at, which is he's a leader. We need him. Let's give him whatever he needs and demands. So, you know, Max, I think you're making a good point, and I think it's important. I don't want to speak for Harvard Business School's admission policy, but I am very proud of the institution. And I think the institution really teaches a different kind of leadership than charismatic leadership.
Max, I just wondered, do you buy that?
To some extent, I actually think that a good leader need to be a charismatic person, because in order to make people follow you, you need to think very well with your followers, and you need to be able to project the vision of the organization. Just following the gray suit, I don't think that many people would be excited of doing that.
Understood. Max, thank you for your call. Rakesh Khurana, I've got to ask you, because I'm still not quite getting this. We've been taught, I mean, never mind mission statement and all these other staples of American corporate life for many years now, but that part of the United States' kind of precious native advantage was that we had outside-the-box thinkers, that unlike Japan, let's say, we taught creativity in our schools. We encouraged creativity. We had people who would stand up and lead to the far shore. And that's why Japan was stuck in a recession and a kind of an economic quagmire in the 90s, and we were going to the moon and the stars. If not that kind of leadership, then what? Are we to import Japanese salarymen to keep everything running with perfect efficiency? Or are you suggesting that there's a category of leader, non-charismatic, but capable of leading breakthrough change that creates new markets, that creates new value, that creates new economic frontiers?
I think I am suggesting the latter, that there is a sense of a type of leadership which is a non-charismatic leadership, which is institutionally oriented. It's not oriented toward fulfilling my vision. It's oriented toward fulfilling the mission of the organization. It's oriented toward strengthening the organization. It's oriented toward the employees. It's oriented toward the customers. The kind of charismatic leadership that I'm talking about is a very narcissistic kind of mm-hmm. vision and a narcissistic type of leadership. The other thing I think it's important to emphasize that a lot of who we think about as charismatic was more of a pseudo-charisma than anything about these individuals.
For example,
appearing on a business magazine enough times sort of lends people a sort of air of charismatic leadership. Flying in on the Gulfstream 5, well-tailored Briani suits, all of these kind of appendages offer like the mask that shamans or medicine mm-hmm. men wear, often give the air of charisma than really tell you anything about the individual. And the point I would respond to to you is, if we really believe we've been choosing our top executives in the largest corporations, which is what I can speak to, on the basis of their leadership qualities, then it appears that leadership seems to be the monopoly of a particular gender group and a particular demographic group.
Because the top corporate leadership in America is so white and so male.
That's right. It's not representative of the population or the working force or the workforce who works in those organizations. So there's something else going on here. And what that something else I think is going on is that the people who are put into the consideration set of who our CEO should mm-hmm. be is a fairly mm-hmm. limited group of people. And it's largely designed and selected from people within the sort of already in the sort of corporate leadership, people who are already on boards, people who already are in the networks and the social clubs. This is what is the main predictor. And I studied, 17 years, 850 companies.
That's a lot
this
of
is
companies.
One of the main predictors of who gets selected CEO is whether you have an interlocking relationship with that person coming from their firm.
Fascinating the way leadership qualities were sprinkled just there by the Lord Almighty.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Rakesh Khurana, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jim Collins. He's author of Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't. He was co-author of Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies. Good evening and welcome, Jim Collins.
Good evening. Can you hear me well?
I can hear you loud and clear, and it's so good to have you with us because Rakesh Khurana has our heads all in a spin here tonight. For years, we've been told that visionary leadership to take companies into new terrain was kind of central to what we needed in the corner office. Rakesh Khurana, as you know, is saying charisma is overrated. Where does that leave us? What are we looking for in American business leadership today?
Well, it's a great question, and first of all, I think we have two complementary points of view here that really go together because the research for both Built to Last and Good to Great came to the same conclusion. We found a negative correlation between outside CEOs and whether companies became great. We also found a negative correlation between what you might describe as charismatic leadership and whether companies became great. And one of the things that we were just stunned as we looked at the kinds of leaders that actually did make companies great as we studied the few companies in history that made a substantial change mm-hmm. from being mediocre enterprises to great enterprises. Of course, one of the questions we wanted to understand is what kind of leadership makes it happen. And like that great story of Sherlock Holmes and the story of the dog and the knight, it was the dog that didn't bark that was interesting. For the most part, in the comparison companies, the ones that failed to make the leap, you've had the people like Lee Iacocca and Stanley Galt and all these high-profile charismatics. And in the few companies that really made the leap, they were CEOs you never heard of. I like to describe that they had a charisma bypass. And in fact, what really stood out about them, though, is something as we began to look at it. And this is the critical thing we concluded. When we really peeled away the onion, and we said, okay, if it's not outside leaders, and that was clearly shown in both studies, the study Jerry Porras and I did at Stanford and the Good to Great study, it clearly wasn't outsiders that make companies great, clearly wasn't the high-profile charismatic. So then leaves the question, well, then what is it that makes them great?
That's the question.
And what we found is that the types of leaders that did bring about these remarkable transformations were people who had a key characteristic. They were ambitious first and foremost for the cause, for the company, for the work, not themselves. And they had the will to make good on that ambition, no matter how difficult the decisions. You have a man like Darwin Smith at Kimberly-Clark, who was a longtime insider. Mm-hmm. And he came in and he had cancer when he became CEO. And one day he comes home and says to his wife, I learned something from my cancer. If you have a cancer in your arm, you have to have the guts to cut off your arm. I've made a decision for our company. I want it to be great. I want to look out on my porch from my porch one day and be able to say, simply looking at a great company in the world, I used to work there. And in order to make that happen, I have to get rid of the cancer. I've decided to sell the mills. And he sold all the company's paper mills and took all the money and threw it into the consumer business to compete head-to-head with Procter & Gamble.
So Jim Collins, I want to ask you then, Rakesh Khurana posits that somehow in the 80s and 90s we turned to a kind of religious extolling of charisma and all the signs and signifiers of power and the tailored suits and the Gulfstream, the guys who had this aura of magical realism, almost voodoo, came into high demand. Why?
Well, if you go back and you read articles on companies all the way back to the turn of the century, and in our research we tend to look at a smaller number of companies. Rakesh looked at 800. In a current time, we looked at a smaller set over a long span of history. And what you find if you go back and you read every article ever written on, say, GE or every article, GE is a good example. Nobody wrote about GE CEOs as a celebrity. Nobody wrote about GE CEOs as a well-known person at all. And yet every CEO prior to Jack Welch was Jack Welch's equal. Every GE CEO prior to Welch was as good for his era as Jack Welch is for his. And it's not that Welch is a better CEO or a worse CEO than previous GE CEOs. He's the same. He's just as good, no better, no worse. So what changed?
Yeah.
What changed is in the 1980s, coincident with the publication of Iacocca's book in 1985, which sold 7 million copies, and coincident with a shift to a media perspective on business, which was fueled by all the magazines figuring out that it's more interesting to write about people. It's easier to write about people, and it sells more magazines to write about people.
So it's all the journalists'
fault. Write about companies. Yes, it was a contextual change, and there was one other key context change, and that is the world got more complex, and as it got more complex, we wanted simpler answers, and we went for the ultimate simple answer, the ultimate statement of ignorance, which is the answer must be a savior leader.
A savior leader. Jim Collins, thanks so much for your perspective tonight. Much appreciated. Jim Collins is author of Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't, and co-author of Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies. Jack Beatty, it sounds like a recipe being brewed between Jim Collins and our guest tonight, Rakesh Khurana, for a new kind of leadership. But do we see companies yet picking up on these cues?
Well, maybe we're having a purge of the charismatic leader. Maybe the institutional context that gave rise to him, very seldom her, has been weakened by these scandals, has been weakened by the nexus that we've seen between stock analysts and boosting the CEO as a way of boosting the value of the company. We've seen a whole generation of sort of journalists, business journalists, have an awful lot of egg on their face for all the adjectives they lathered on these people who turned out to be very false gods indeed.
We're talking tonight about the charismatic CEO. Listeners, are we making charisma the whipping boy for our stock market losses? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the charismatic CEO with Rakesh Khurana. He's professor at Harvard Business School and author of Searching for a Corporate Savior, The Irrational Quest for Charismatic CEOs. What do you think? Have charismatic CEOs made American business great or driven it into a ditch? And if not charismatic voltage, then what is great leadership in business? What makes it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin is on the line. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
It's kind of a privilege to be talking to your two guests. I've read Good to Great, and I have yet to read Rakesh's work, but it sounds interesting. This is like a hobby of mine. And one of the things I wanted to comment on.
Yes.
Of a couple, very importantly, is that charismatic leaders and the individuals you're talking about are very, very intelligent people. And if they're not surrounded with people who can challenge them, they believe their own bravado. Therefore, if it's somebody from the outside who doesn't understand
the core of the business, mm-hmm. they will start to believe their own ideas anyway.
Because they have such fertile minds, they'll be making it up.
They'll be making it up, and it happens, and they stop listening.
Kevin, are you suggesting that if a charismatic CEO is surrounded by smart, focused, good colleagues, that he or she might work well?
Might. Only might, because don't forget they are a unique personality of their own. And depending on the surroundings, they may very easily start to believe the fact that they are as good as they think they are. Mm-hmm. There's a great example. About 10 years ago, when New Coke came out, there was a criticism of the guy after it was a failed campaign.
Right.
There was a criticism of that individual. It was a VP of marketing of Coca-Cola, and they said this individual forgot that being smarter than everybody in the room didn't, or rather, knowing more than everybody in the room didn't mean you knew everything.
It's not enough. Kevin, thank you for your call. Rakesh Khurana, what about it? Our caller, Kevin, asserts that charismatic leaders are highly intelligent. If reality doesn't match with what they think, they'll make up an alternative reality. Did you find that intelligence and charisma necessarily correlate?
Well, I think, you know, most of the executives who are sort of chosen and who sort of have made it to that level are intelligent. I think that's sort of a given, their intelligence along a variety of different measures. But I think the listener is exactly right that people who are charismatic, who sort of believe in their own vision, tend to breathe their own exhaust. They tend to sort of find the facts that sort of fit with their view of the world and mm-hmm. discount and reject those facts are not consistent with their view of the world. And part of the issue is that they also surround themselves with people often who push them and are consistent with their view of the world, mm. are on their team, and see the world in the same way.
But let me ask you this then. Were charismatic CEOs a necessary corollary of the 1990s bubble? The whole new economy idea. It was almost actively understood in those days, I think, that you needed people who could – no one quite understood it. So you need people who had the kind of brass and bravado to just bull through to the other side.
Right. I think one of the issues that we do know about charismatic leadership is that societies and people always turn to charismatic leadership in times of great uncertainty and times of great change. And we often look to charismatic leaders to make sense of these events for us. In some cases, they could be wrong. In some cases, they could be right. But in many ways, it's a way of avoiding to have to make your own decisions and your own judgments. But let me just shift quickly to the political context. You know, we could take sort of one of the most rational societies that had ever existed, the sort of German society in the 1930s. You know, these were the people who gave us bureaucracy, who gave us the sort of notion of the rational bureaucratic individual. And there, during times of, you know, Great Depression, economic uncertainty, political uncertainty, a lack of confidence, even that society became very susceptible toward charismatic authority in the form of Adolf Hitler, which led to sort of disastrous events. And so it's not uncommon in human societies to see, when there's lots of change and uncertainty, people turning toward charismatic authority.
But if America doesn't have charismatic leadership, then what distinguishes, or what can distinguish, American business from Japanese business with the woes we see there today, from European business with the kind of economic sclerosis that we associate perhaps too easily with Europe? But what's the distinguishing gift of the American economy, or is that just a charismatic notion to think that we have or must have one?
I think the distinguishing gift of the American economy has always been a meritocracy. The notion is that the people who lead are those who lead on the basis of their competence. They're not selected on the basis of having been born into the right family, which is often very common in traditional societies. You're sort of the sire of the of someone. It's also been consistent with people who express their individuality about creating systems in organizations where that individuality, those ideas can be expressed, discussed, and eventually implemented. The notion of charismatic leadership actually works against all of these principles.
Because charisma trumps meritocracy.
Charisma trumps meritocracy, and often who we see as charismatic tells us more about the followers than it tells us about the leaders.
Let's try and get one more call. Eleanor's on the line. Welcome, Eleanor. You're on the air.
You've been talking about IQ, but there's such a thing as EQ, emotional quotient, and when the two are quite high, that it gives a good indication that there might be a good leader there. In addition, if you go back to pre-human, pre-Homo sapien times, like, for instance, the chipmunks or the apes, what they were, the leaders there were the people, the apes who had the most females, the most sexual attraction, and also could dominate, manipulate, and control the best. And today, we understand, because we're human beings, that it's not by power and not by might, but we have a way of putting a totem pole on every individual and where they rate on this totem pole.
Eleanor, our time's running short, but I think we've got the gist of it. Is it still sex appeal? Is there a way we can resist this kind of silverback ape at the head of the corporation? Is there a more rational way? And what do we need in terms of board approach, board of directors approach to accomplish that?
I think it's a great question. I think the first thing it has to start with is, where do they want to take the company? The notion is, what is the strategy? If you don't know where you're going, anyone's going to take you there. But instead, what we should start is the board should start taking responsibility for the strategy of the company, identifying the direction they want to take the company, recognizing that it's going to take more than one individual to implement this strategy. In fact, you have to look at the whole executive team and the capabilities of that organization and that executive team. Start with their skills. What are the skills that are missing that are going to be required for taking us from point A to point B? And then you begin the first step toward a more rational succession process.
Rakesh Khurana, we thank you for digging into those 850 companies and coming out with some very timely insights. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Rakesh Khurana is professor at Harvard Business School and author of Searching for a Corporate Savior, The Irrational Quest for Charismatic CEOs. Jack Beatty, this sounds like a message very much in tune with the times. If we've been drinking the Kool-Aid, Rakesh Khurana says, stop.
Sober up, yeah. I mean, and look at the history of American business. I mean, Alfred P. Sloan was the greatest corporate leader of the 20th century, and he was so lacking in charisma that when a journalist once went to interview him, and he crossed his legs, he saw that the man was wearing long underwear. I mean, what could be less charismatic than that? Theodore Vail of AT&T. The great business leaders have been men who made fundamental strategic decisions, had nothing to do with charisma.
But they had their long johns. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Coming up, a look inside the mind of a suspected terrorist. This is On Point. Kamel Daoudi seemed an unlikely candidate to become an alleged terrorist. He was born in Algeria, but spent most of his life in middle-class France, and he studied science and engineering at the University of Paris. But in his late teens, Daoudi embraced a militant form of Islam. Now, 28 years old, he stands accused of plotting to blow up the American embassy in Paris and conspiring with Al-Qaeda. From his jail cell south of Paris, where he is awaiting trial, Kamel Daoudi recently wrote three essays that unveil the mindset of an educated Arab who has chosen to embrace a hatred of the West. The New York Times acquired the essays, which were originally sent to a French television station. Here's an excerpt of the essays of Kamel Daoudi as read by WBUR's Ian Doherty.
The context of the time was the war in Algeria, where they were about to set up a regime based on Islamic law. The West hated us because we were Arabs and Muslims. France did everything possible to ensure that Algeria would not be an Islamic state. It backed an illegitimate and profoundly one-sided regime by sending weapons, helicopters, and even the Foreign Legion. Not many people know about that. The massacres committed by the Algerian army were the last straw for me. I could no longer study serenely. All of the pressure that had been put on me during my school years so that I would succeed at any price suddenly transformed itself into energy to challenge radically my environment and my father. From that moment on, I didn't want anything to do with the West. There were only two choices left for me, either to sink into a deep depression, and I did for more than 6 months at the end of my second year at university, or to react by taking part in the universal struggle against this overwhelming, unjust cynicism. So I reviewed everything that I had learned and put all of my knowledge into a new perspective. I then understood that the only person worth devoting my life to was Allah. Everything suddenly became clear to me. and I understood why Abraham went into exile, why Moses rebelled against the Pharaoh, why Jesus was spat upon, and why Muhammad said, "I came with the sword on Judgment Day." My battle was and will be to eradicate all powers that are opposed to the law of Allah, the Most High. Whatever the price may be, because only our Creator has the power to make laws, and any system based on the laws of men is artifice and lies. This glorious battle will not stop until the law of Allah has been re-established and applied by a just and honest caliph. I had to succeed by acquiring enough political tools so that I could know my enemy well and fight back. I discovered the great contemporary writers of political Islam. I read them in French or in English because my Arabic wasn't good enough. I knew that a victory of Islam over the West was possible. I decided to go to Algiers in the middle of the war, with the curfew and the shooting that was taking place. For 4 months, I saw the situation with my own eyes, and I experienced the roadblocks and the intervention of the Algerian military security forces. France was a major protagonist in this conflict. I could not accept the fact that the former colonial power was continuing to control my country's destiny, when so many women, children, and men had been tortured, massacred, raped, and assassinated. The Algerian War, the Bosnian War, the Gulf War, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Palestine, Lebanon. All of these events strengthened my conviction that the Judeo-Christian community, influenced by atheism, has a visceral hatred of the community of Muhammad. For all these reasons, and because of all these events which have left indelible wounds, I went over to the forces of the dark side. My ideological commitment is total, and the reward of glory for this relentless battle is to be called a terrorist. I accept the name of terrorist if it is used to mean that I terrorize a one-sided system of iniquitous power and a perversity that comes in many forms. I have never terrorized innocent individuals, and I will never do so. But I will fight any form of injustice and those who support it. My fight will only end in my death or in my madness.
An excerpt of the essays of alleged terrorist Kamel Daoudi is read by WBUR's Ian Doherty. Jack Beattie, there's a window opened into a mindset looking at the world from a very, very different pole.
Yes, and he stresses the Algerian election of 1992 when it looked as if the Islamists were going to win in the government, which, of course, in an earlier generation was the center of the Muslim admiration for its anti-colonial efforts against the French. The government mm-hmm. aborted the election. And the West acquiesced in that. But he mentions the massacres perpetrated by the government. My God, something around 100,000 people were most bloodily killed by the Islamists in reaction. And all that he just leaves out.
Fair enough, but it's not really a debate of that kind, is it? It's a kind of leap to belief. And when it's that deep, that looks like a very difficult thing to turn around.
Yes, and of course he was raised in France, and you'd think that would immunize him to a certain extent about this. But I do think this business of being blind to the moral ambiguity of his own cause is so defining of these minds. I mean, any killing that advances his cause is great. Everything else is just murder. Well, it's all murder.
And maybe lots of it, I'm afraid. Jack Beattie, thanks for being on with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.